I'm going to start with the focus on communal redemption, talking more about the Kehillah, and bouncing off some thoughts on that. I'll start with research that many of you may have heard of by Dr. Duke. Dr. Duke at Emory University, who's a leading researcher in the area of the power of family narrative as a source of resilience. And he's done all of this really important research, for example, showing that after 9/11, children most directly impacted by loss and by exposure, living right near the World Trade Center, those who came from families where there was a strong sense of understanding what's the family story? What are the sources of success and failure in this family? And just knowing basic facts about our family and our community, which is exactly what the whole yontif of Pesach is all about, those kids did better than those who did not have that sense of being rooted in the community. So I wanted to start with that, just to bounce off some thoughts with you all in terms of the power of connection at the Seder and beyond for the whole yontif of Pesach. I will focus first with the story of a conference I was invited to speak at that was I wasn't clear what it was about, but I got invited to be one of two speakers at a homeless conference. And I sort of pictured going and being able to hang out with a bunch of homeless people in the middle of Manhattan, which sounded pretty interesting to me. But of course, that's not what it was. It turned out that it was in the ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria. This was many years ago, and there were 400 very well-dressed professionals in the area of homelessness. And the other speaker was this incredibly impressive man. He was very good looking. He was very incredibly well dressed. I'm usually not tuned into those kind of things, but even I could see that he was well dressed. And his CV said the following. It said that he has his bachelor's from Harvard, his PhD from Harvard. He's in charge of homeless policy for the United States government. He's a man who had just won an Oscar the year before because of a documentary he made on homelessness. It was incredibly impressive and daunting for me to be the only other speaker on the program. So he gets up to start his talk, and everybody is expecting to hear, a traditional talk. His opening words were so shocking to everybody there. You almost saw 400 people collectively fall off of their chairs. Here's his opening words. He said, "When I was 11 years old, in front of me, my father, in a coked up rage, high on cocaine, ended my mother's life and then shot himself. And I was an only child." And there was something about that that was just so shocking and so unexpected. And he said, "Now I'm going to tell you the story of how I ended up here." And he tells the story of how he runs away. He knew what the foster care system in that particular part of the world was about. He didn't want to fall into that system. He was a very bright guy, but he runs away. And he looked a little older than his age. And any time he'd come to a homeless shelter where he thought they were onto him, he would run to another homeless shelter. And he described living an unbelievably stressful 2 years where he'd go from homeless shelter to homeless shelter, totally ridden by all of the trauma he had been through in his life before and after the murder-suicide of his parents. He said, "I went on like this until I come into a shelter in Manhattan." And there I heard four words that forever changed my life and is the reason why I'm here. And you see 400 pens come out. And so all of these professionals get ready, you know, wow, it's amazing to have four words that'll allow us to perform miracles. And he tells everybody, just put your pens away. He says, it wasn't the words, it was how they were spoken. He said, I walk into a shelter and the director of the shelter looks me in the eye, clearly in a way that showed that he was connecting. And he puts his arm around me. And he says, how are you doing? Those are the four words. And I saw that he meant it. And I just started talking to him. And the more I spoke to him, the more I saw that he was interested in hearing about my life. And we started meeting on a regular basis as I moved into that shelter for a couple of months. And he saw that I was a pretty bright guy. And he gets me a scholarship to the Dalton School. From there, I earned a scholarship to Harvard undergraduate and then for my PhD. And here I am. It's all from those four words. And that's what I want to open with. The holiday, the Yontif of Pesach, it's all about being able to find a place for, as in the Lashon of the Rambam, the Mare Lev and Umlale Nefesh. For those among us who are depressed or unfortunate. Now, unfortunately, we're still at a point in the pandemic that many of us are not necessarily, you know, ready to have a full Seder table with being able to invite, you know, the broader community. But some of us can now that, you know, more and more of us are a couple of weeks past our second vaccination. But it's just something to think about, to remind ourselves about, you know, the power of that. My mother-in-law, who was an unbelievably gifted in Hachnasas Archim. So she would always, tell me when I'd spend time there, she'd say, listen, it's easy to invite people to your Seder or invite people in general for a Shabbos who are your good friends and who are easy to talk to and who you enjoy common interests with. She says the challenge is how do you bring those who are Mare Lev and Umlale Nefesh, those who might be suffering with anxiety and with depression. They're not so easy to be with, but I'll tell you, in my experience, every time over the years that we've found such people to be at our Seder table or to be with us for the various meals of Yontif, they're invariably the most interesting people, and they're invariably the people who give us the greatest perspective, and it expands our awareness. You know, it's very clearly, you know, the word Natan, which is a palindrome, as we all know, is when you give, you get back. And that's just one of the thoughts that always rushes through my mind at the Seder. I wanted to share with you, again, you know, we're talking about, it's such an amazing religion. I don't know of other religions where we make our children into the heroes and into the really the core of what the Seder is all about, and we believe in them. There's somehow the power of believing. I want to share a couple of thoughts on that from some of the research on this. There's fascinating study done by Dr. Ellen Langer at Harvard. She's one of the leading psychologists in the United States and a very creative kind of researcher. A number of years ago, she finds an abandoned monastery on the outskirts of Cambridge, not too far from Harvard. And she takes over the monastery and she changes it, redesigns it to look like the world looked many years ago, where the 70, 80, and 90-year-old men that she's now inviting to spend 5 days in this converted monastery, She has it look like the world looked when they were at their peak, at their prime, when they were 40 years old. So she changes the wallpaper. She swaps the color TVs for black and white TVs. And in general, the decor is the decor of the way the world looked when these men were 40 years old. And then she tells them when they come to the monastery, here's what I want you to do. I want you to spend, we're going to spend the next 5 days here. But the most important thing to in terms of your mindset over the next 5 days is picture yourself as being 40-year-old men. You're at your prime. You're now men in your 70s, 80s, and 90s. Think of yourself as being 40. And they went to extremes to do that. The men had a room on the third floor. They didn't get any help in carrying up their clothing to the third floor, even if they had to carry their clothing one shirt at a time to where their room was. They did it, and it was done in a spirit of excitement. And there was real camaraderie between the men during that 5 day period. Then there was a control group that did this a week later. Except that they were treated like the old men that they were. And they did a bunch of measures after the 5 days in both groups. And among the most amazing things that they found is that after only 5 days of thinking that they were younger and treating their colleagues like they're younger, they became younger, meaning that when independent raters rated before and after pictures of both groups, they had 100% accuracy in picking out the men who were in who treated each other like they were younger. They literally, in only 5 days, started to look younger. Their vision, they had a team of ophthalmologists measure their vision, not knowing who was in what group, and their vision significantly improved. Okay, it's interesting. Chazal tell us that when we stop ourselves from being in a rush and we slow down and we become mindful, our vision improves. I think, what is it, by 1/60th that the Gemara tells us? Our vision literally improves. And these men, their vision improved. It didn't improve forever, but it improved for, if I remember correctly, for a good number of weeks. In general, they were happier. They showed more strength, greater manual dexterity. And in my favorite footnote on the study is there was a journalist who was allowed to observe the study, and he wrote that as these men were waiting for the bus to take them back to their homes in Cambridge, these old men spontaneously started to play a game of two-hand touch football. The power of expectation, the power of believing in one another. And I think that's very much in keeping with the theme of this Yontif, including, our children having the starring roles in the night of the Seder. There's a beautiful thought that is a story that made the rounds in the last couple of years, but it impacted me so much to hear it. It's a story that I heard from a grandchild of Rav Aryeh Levin when I was in a scholar in residence in Boca, and I heard a talk while I was there from this grandchild who told the following story. We all know Rav Aryeh Levin was this amazingly warm and connected and accepting man. And there was a kid in the neighborhood who grew up on his block, who evidently started to become a little bit rebellious. He stopped wearing a yarmulke. He didn't show up in shul anymore. He basically went off of our way of life. Rav Aryeh Levin was trying, who was a short man, and this boy was a tall boy. He was trying very hard to try to catch this young man who was about, I don't know, 19 years old, 18, 19 years old, to just talk to him, to give him chizuk. And every time he saw him, the boy would run away. Finally, he caught up with him. And he says, Yossi, I've missed you so much. How are you? It's so great to finally see you. So Yossi says, listen, I'm just embarrassed. You can see I'm not even wearing a yarmulke. I'm not the person you knew, and I'm embarrassed at the way I've fallen in terms of my observance of Torah and mitzvos. So Rav Levin looked at him with a big smile, and he's standing right opposite the chest of this Yossi, and he says, listen, Yossi, all I know is from here, all I can see is your heart. And I think that's the mindset that we have to think about. By the way, Yontif is sometimes difficult, 3 day Yontif, especially if it's the first time that we're going to be together with some family. It's extremely exciting, but we might be a little rusty in terms of our ability to not lose it and to have patience, where the muscle of patience might have been worn a little bit in the last couple of in the last year. So that's something to think about. And then I'll just end this section with beautiful thought that I've heard from my brother-in-law, from Rabbi Rafi Butler, on the collective memory of the Seder table. It's just such a beautiful, beautiful thought on the power of connection and the power of community. So he says, think about a Seder table, especially in pre-pandemic times. And I'm thinking about the Seder table for most of my, most of my middle-aged part of my life. So you'd have my father Zal at the head of the table, and he would tell us stories and divrei Torah, and it was often an amazing, amazing kind of experience. But he would talk about his memories of what he would hear from his father, from my grandfather, who had learned with the Chafetz Chaim, and who was very close to the Alter from Slabodka, and had amazing stories. And as I was growing up, but also towards the end of my father's life, we would hear these stories, and my grandchildren would be at the other end of the table. And they would listen raptly to these stories, these 7, 8, 9-year-old grandchildren. Okay. Now, if you think about the collective memory of that table, it spans about 300 years. Okay. Going from the oldest memory of the oldest memory of the oldest member at the Seder table, in this case, my father, to the future memory of the youngest member who will one day, God willing, he or she will lead the Seder of their own. Okay. And when you think about such a table, it roughly spans 300 years of collective memory. And if you take those tables, that table, and put 10 such tables side by side, it will go back to Yetzias Mitzrayim. You'll have literally that 300 years over those 10 tables will go back to Yetzias Mitzrayim. We're not so far. We're not so far from the origin of what we're celebrating of the holiday of the Yontif of Cheres. It's I think a powerful kind of thought connecting us to the connection part. Let's talk a little bit about personal redemption. I wanted to talk a little bit about hope. And it's interesting because when you deconstruct hope, when you deconstruct it in terms of the research on the psychology of hope, what it comes down to is actually, I think, pretty fascinating. Okay. The core is how do we think about our goals? How do we think about our ability to produce workable kinds of pathways to achieving our goals, right? We learn in Mishlei, be'ein chazon yifara'am. Without that vision thing, we lose sight of ourselves. Hope is about connecting to where we're going. Where are we? Who are we? Where are we going? What are we going to do with what we have? As Yaakov prepared his army for the fateful encounter with Esav. And then the third component in deconstructing hope is, can I do it? Do I believe in myself enough to believe that I could do it? And there's that beautiful, beautiful Rabbeinu Tzadok of Lublin that says, "Kishem shitzarech adam lahamin ba'Hashem yisparach." Just like we need to believe in God, kach sarach achar kach lahamin ba'atzmo, so too do we need to believe in ourselves. Ratzalomar, Rabbeinu Tzadok says, okay? She'enenu po'el batel sh'bein layla hoya u'bein layla avad. We're not an insignificant being here one day and gone the next. We matter. We matter. And it's that component of hope that we're talking about here. You know, there's a beautiful thought that I heard originally from Rabbi Dr. Fox in California and Diane and Dede Haredes in Yerushalayim. And it's quoting, I first saw this in the Slonimer. It's just a beautiful thought. Many of you might have seen this. It's on the Pasuk of Lishuascha Kivisi Hashem. Right in the middle of Yaakov's brachos of his children, it says Lishuascha Kivisi Hashem. And here's what the Medrash tells us in the Bereishis Rabbah. Hakol b'kivui. Everything has to be dealt with and met with hope. Okay. Yisurin, suffering like a pandemic, b'kivui, has to be dealt with hope. And ultimately, geula b'kivui, our ultimate redemption is with hope. And you think about the beautiful symbolism of the Hebrew word for hope, the Hebrew word tikva, is translated into the word for a cord or a rope, meaning we're never dangling helplessly in the wind. There's always the connection between us and God, Bein Adam L'Makom, and Bein Adam L'Atzmo, hopefully between us and ourselves. And one of the things that this pandemic has done for people, I'm hearing it all over the world in the different connections that I've had and been hearing in different talks I've been giving and different conversations I've been having in different parts of the world, that we're not, there's much more room now during this period of time that fortunately and unfortunately we're ending, for being able to take a step back and appreciate what we have, and to have gratitude for what we have, and to have hope for what we have. That's the key, you know. And we want to continue as we're gradually getting back to the next step, you know, as more and more of us are getting vaccinated, and hopefully we're going to be able to start to think about a real reentry. I mean, there's a real feeling of excitement in the air. That's you know, unbelievable as we're able to reconnect. But there's also a bittersweet feeling, because we're going to also lose the stillness that we've been able to appreciate it. You know, the key to spiritual connection in many ways, in many of the research studies on the psychology of religion, and when I've been at various programs where we've asked people what they consider to be the greatest source of spiritual connection, is often stillness. It's the ability to find a place of quiet and focus and mindfulness. That's the key. So the pandemic has provided us with that stillness. What I'm worried about is that as we go back to whatever the new definition of reconnection is going to be about, I'd hate for us to lose that lesson. You know, I hope that we're able to continue to find a way to reconnect. You know, we had some company that we haven't been able to have for a year in terms of some of our, you know, children who, and grandchildren who were able to come for Shabbos, you know, past vaccination and all of that. And we had such an amazing appreciation for something as simple as being able to go to shul with the grandchild, to be able to have long conversations, to be able to hug them. It was unbelievable, you know? And I'm so worried about it, us going back to the Hergel, what my father Zal would always call the ordeal of the ordinary, you know? It's so easy to lose that. And I'm hoping that one of the things that we do this Pesach is we figure out a way to almost bottle the feelings of gratitude and appreciation that are beginning to come our way for those of us who are gradually re-entering. Okay. Let me spend, we're in our last 15 minutes. I'm just going to, just in the spirit of being Nose Ba'olam Chavero, I came across a lecture I gave last year to a group of men and women who were struggling with the aftermath of a divorce, but here it's mostly women we're talking about, last year at the beginning of the pandemic. And there was tremendous anxiety there because there were so many people who were having a Seder alone, okay? And we were getting a lot of questions, like what if a woman is leading the Seder? And it reminded me of how we have to be Nose Ba'olam Chaver. We have to be there with our heart and our souls in terms of supporting those people who don't necessarily have the ability to have a Seder, you know, surrounded with many people. We're not quite there yet in the community. So this is just some thoughts on it. Nothing brilliant here, other than you know, we know what's the halacha, as I understand it. I'm just speaking as a psychologist. I have no right to speak about this in any other way. But what happens if you're a doctor and you're on call and you're working all Seder night, okay, in the hospital? Or if you're, let's say in this case, a woman who's having the Seder all alone, do you say the Manishtana? You know, do you ask the four questions? Okay, so the Psak, as I've heard it, and again, I hope this is widely accepted, is that even if alone, we're supposed to ask ourselves the question. Doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, even if we're alone, we have to ask ourselves the questions that's at the heart of the Seder night, okay? And which I find fascinating because, you know, as we talk about, you know, what's at the core of religious communication, which is what the Seder is all about, of passing from one generation to the next, it's most effectively done when we listen well and listen carefully, when we help our children ask questions and we help ourselves ask questions. And we're good at listening and hearing and presenting multiple perspectives, right? The truth, the Torah was given in the Arafel, in the mist, in the grays. And I think that's an extremely important thing to think about. Let me move on here to talk about a couple of other thoughts here. So one is a thought that I always find to be very meaningful. I've shared it with some of you in the past, and it's the story of a close colleague of mine. Interestingly, his latest book has been at the top of the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list for some reason. I don't know why, but it's come alive again, and it's been at the, you know, right towards the top. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. His name is Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. He'd been at Harvard, and now he's at Boston University Medical School. And we used to work very closely together, working on some research we had done on post-traumatic stress disorder. And one day he was working with me in the hospital that I used to work at before I was at YU at Northwell Hospital. And he comes running into my office all excited. And he has the picture of an fMRI, a picture of a brain of one of his patients who he had scanned his brain when he was reliving the worst moment of his life. He was stuck in the stairwell of the World Trade Center, convinced he was about to die. He somehow miraculously survived. And he shows me, David, look at what the brain looks like when the brain thinks that it's about to die. He was having a flashback to this moment. And the first thing that ran through my head when I saw this were the words Vayidom Aharon. Okay, the famous Abarbanel on Vayidom Aharon. What's the difference between sheket and dmimut? What's the difference between silence and dhamma? It says, is sheket is for when you sort of have the words in your head for the meaning of what's going on. Dhamma is for when you're literally rendered speechless by what's happening. So it's a fascinating kind of thing that he showed me. Then he showed me subsequent scans as he went on, okay, to work with this patient of his. As he was helping this man name the monster and give words to his pain. So as you saw Broca's area, the language centers of the brain light up, that's when the refuah came from giving words for the pain. So let me tie this now to Seder night, and it'll be chazara for some of you, but it's just, I think, a magnificent thought. So in the Haggadah Meimaron, written at the in the early 1900s by Rabbi Charlap of YU's grandfather. Okay, so in the Haggadah Meimaron, he says the following. He says, Avdus, slavery, the slavery we suffered in Mitzrayim, takes away our koach hadibur. It takes away our power of speech. It shuts down the Broca's area. And what do we do on Seder night? What do we do when we gather around the table with our family and with our guests and with the people we love? What do? What's it called? Magid. That's the meaning of Magid. We light up the language centers of the brain. Our answer to having our koach hadibur taken away from us by our suffering and slavery is to get together with everything that family means to us in terms of meaning, everything that chinuch means to us in terms of meaning, and everything that comes with that whole connection. And that's what Magid is all about. And I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful thought that Rabbi Chalap talks about. Okay, let me do one more thought, a little bit on the power of music, because I was just thinking about, how much music is tied in to Pesach. It's not until the last part of Pesach that we get more formally into Shira, but it's woven in throughout. And I just wanted to share with you a couple of thoughts as we come to 9:15. I'm sorry, to 10:15. I'm living in the past. Okay, so I'll share with you a story I heard first from my wonderful colleague, Norman Blumenthal. But it's in a wonderful book by Dr. Isaacson. Who's I don't know if you've read. He had a new book that just came out a couple of days ago. There's just so much wisdom in his books that it's incredible. But this is about the power of music. So he talks about a close student of Beethoven, a Jewish woman who lost her young child. I don't know if it was to an epidemic or what it was to, but she suddenly lost her young child, and she was beyond tears. She couldn't cry. She just couldn't cry. And we all know that. Tears is a gift, and it's often a gift that doesn't come so easily. Okay? And you have to be in a certain psychological headspace in order to have the gift of tears. Agra d'hespeda yalula, the Gemara in Brachos tells us. So Beethoven heard about how she was suffering and how she couldn't cry. So he invites this woman, who was a close talmid of his, to his house. And he doesn't say a word to her. He says not a word to her. He sits down with her and he just starts playing music. He just starts pouring his heart out with the wordless connection of music. And he does this for quite some time, doesn't say a word until she breaks out sobbing. He opens the gates of tears for her, and she's able to release the tears. You know, during the pandemic, some of us have been able to cry. There's been a lot of loss. If you take normal tears and put them under a microscope, tears that we shed because of an allergy, it'll just be salt and water. But if you take the kind of emotional tears that this woman shed and put it under a microscope, it's a whole different chemical mix. It's going to be filled with stress hormones. It's going to be filled with all kinds of physiologic and neurochemical correlates of stress. And that's the really the gift of tears that he gave her. And that's what music does for us. And I'll just share with you at the end a beautiful story I heard Thursday night. Thursday night there was Chanukah Sabayis of Rav Aryeh Leibowitz of our one of the Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz, an amazing leader, an amazing man, and they built a beautiful new building in his shul. And there was afterwards, for only for people who were fully 2 weeks past the full inoculation, there was like a kumsitz with Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, famous Chabad Rav, who I've been privileged to know very well over the years because we often give talks together. So he told a story, which is what I want to end with. It was the story of Rav Zalman Taibel, the men who were at this get together on Thursday night. This was an amazing experience. He didn't leave till 3:30 in the morning. Okay, he had a driver to take him home, but it was amazing because people were sort of drunk with the power of being able to connect. They hadn't been together for a full year, and it's such a such there's such excitement, but also there's some challenge that comes with it. So he tells the following story. He says there was a well-known man in the Lubavitch community by the name of Zalman Taibel, who unfortunately was suffering with severe dementia. And he ended up in a in a I guess a center for extended care for people with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. And he was vacant. He was gone. If you looked at him, you could see he was no longer there. And it was Erev Yom Kippur. And there was a huge line of people just before Yom Kippur waiting to get a bracha from the Rebbe. And it was very fast. There wasn't time to do very much. The Rebbe would just, I guess, quickly give the dollar and give a quick bracha. And it was the line moved along. It was snaking around blocks and blocks and blocks of Crown Heights. And then somebody wheels Zalman Taibel to him. And he immediately recognizes him, and he recognizes the vacant look in his eyes. He sees this is a man who's neurologically severely compromised. He's not even there. He doesn't even respond to seeing the Rebbe. So the Rebbe, in spite of the incredible time pressure, it's Erev Yom Kippur, he starts to sing the beautiful niggun that Rav Zalman was famous for singing. And it was a niggun that was a complicated, long niggun, and he starts singing. And at first, Rav Zalman doesn't respond, but then a light goes on in his eyes, and the Rebbe starts dancing with him. And he starts dancing with him nonstop with a look of joy in Lubavitcher Rebbe's eyes. And Rav Zalman comes back. It's almost like a tchiyas hameisim. He comes back. He comes back and he connects to the niggun. So what Rwaiwai said, the de definition of love is somebody who can sing to you when you have forgotten the tune. It's somebody who can sing to you when you have forgotten the tune. Okay? Hopefully we haven't forgotten the tune. We haven't forgotten the tune of what it's like to be together without our masks and to reconnect in a full way with our family, with our children, with our grandchildren, and with our community. And if I could give a bracha to all of us, as I'm excited to listen to my colleagues speak next, it's a bracha of being able to, for us all to be able to sing a new tune to one another, which is clearly at the heart of what this Yontif is all about. Thank you, everybody.